Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Zach Powers.
Hello.
Hello, Zach. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you, John?
Okay. It's been... Sophomore Lit listeners will probably take note that it's been a little while since I've had a podcast. I apologize for that. The summer was a little stranger than I thought it was going to be. But now I'm back reading books for your listening pleasure. And Zach, thank you very much for helping me kickstart this exciting new fall series of readings. Zach, why don't you tell everyone out there who you are and where they might have heard you?
I'm Zach Powers. I've been on this podcast 2 or 3 times. I feel like I may have lost count. I think the last time was Crime and Punishment, which was a little while ago. I also have a podcast of my own with my friend Brian Flynn. It's an alternate history comedy podcast called The Revisionists, where we create an account of a true account of a person or event from history. And then we also offer a completely fictitious, as irreverent or silly or ridiculous, alternate account of that person or event from history. And then at the end, vote on what becomes the real history of the world going forward. So, that is the other thing you may know me from. And timely for the release of this show, also frequent guest of this podcast, Shannon Camp is releasing a Little Women audio drama podcast that you can find through Little Women Podcast, in which I will be playing Lori, and I believe John is playing Captain March, if I'm not mistaken.
A lot of times on Sophomore Lit, I get complaints from various listeners that the books I'm doing don't necessarily fit into the theme of high school literature or literature you read when you were in class. But this book falls squarely, I think, into that arena of books you are probably going to be assigned at one time or another in your English career. And that is Virginia Woolf's 1925 Mrs. Dalloway.
Yeah. I read this book because I was assigned it not in high school, but in freshman or sophomore year of college. I can't recall which right now, but I believe a women's literature class. And this was one of the books that was assigned in that class. And that was the first time I was exposed to it.
People, I think, are either generally assigned to The Lighthouse or Mrs. Dalloway. I actually read both those books one after another I was a little late getting to them in a graduate course in English modernism. But my son, who is in college right now, just read Mrs. Dalloway, and I lent him my old copy, which isn't as romantic as it might seem, because by the time I was in grad school, I had become very precious with my books, and I didn't write notes in them or underline them or highlight them. So he just got like a blank copy of Mrs. Dalloway from me. So
I read the same copy I read when I was in college, and I remember liking it a great deal when I was in college. I'll save my judgment on it nowadays for a moment, but despite that, I had very little notation in my copy from college. It was almost completely blank, except for one or two parts that I had made very light notation of.
You know, I'm disappointed in both of us, because this is a book that kind of needs notation. I remember loving this book when I read it in graduate school, and I found it strangely a little harder to read now that I'm older and now that I have more experience. Maybe I had more patience for this kind of highly experimental prose when I was younger. But you know, we'll get to Final Judgments when we get to Final Judgments. So this is Mrs. Dalloway. This is the first great novel by Virginia Woolf, written in 1925, and it's the one that made her mark on the literary world. It was a sensation. Some people think of this book as a response to Ulysses by James Joyce, a book that Virginia Woolf had complicated feelings about. But you can see why. They're both books that deal with people walking around cities.
Yeah. And I mean, when you look up, you know, the first two results, I think, for like stream of consciousness books are Miss Dalloway and Ulysses, and then a few other Virginia Woolf, James Joyce novels, and then like On the Road. But yeah, they're very much in that same very fly by the seat, like things move very quickly and fluidly, and you're jumping from one character to the next in a way that sometimes is very difficult to catch on to in the moment. It takes you a moment to adjust to the fact that you have changed point of views because there is no clear demarcation line.
When I was preparing for this podcast, I listened to an excellent single episode of the BBC podcast In Our Time, which was which had a roundtable discussion of Mrs. Dalloway, and part of what was charming about it was to hear a roundtable of fusty British critics discussing this book and kind of arguing over it. But one of the things that I really wish I could remember her name. The English professor from a Scottish university was very upset about the categorization of this book as a stream of consciousness novel, because she wanted to differentiate it between the kind of stream of consciousness that we associate with Joyce, and most specifically with things like Molly Bloom's soliloquy at the end of Ulysses, where ideas flow one into another and we're kind of totally inside a character's head, and that's the way that the action unfolds. And she sees this as more of the continuation of what's called the free indirect style, which everyone associates with Jane Austen, where we have a third person narrator, but that third person narrator takes on the concerns and point of view and something to the character of the individual characters in turn, or sure, you know. And I think that's an interesting distinction to make, but you know, ultimately all these discussions are subjective, I guess.
Yeah, notably, there is like at least a couple sections, especially the first half of the book deals with characters moving mostly around Regent Park. And there are segments of the book where characters who have never shown up before and will never show up again, we enter into sort of, again, from the third person perspective, their point of view, and very briefly get their sort of thoughts and opinions on various things, like an airplane skywriting in the sky, only for those characters to sort of never show up again. So yeah, it jumps extremely freely and extremely quickly between perspectives and thoughts and realism and hallucination at times, and fantasy and flashback. So it is very freewheeling in that regard.
It is a book that has an interesting conception of time. I mean, just briefly for anyone who doesn't know the book, this is a book that is the titular Mrs. Dalloway, Clarissa Dalloway, is a well-to-do upper-class woman, 52 years of age, and the important event of the day for her is that she will be throwing a party in her London townhouse for the, is it the Prime Minister is coming?
I believe the Prime Minister coming is a last minute surprise, but it's for like the well-to-do, the lords and lady of London, basically, like her people she knows who are involved in the government or in the cabinet or otherwise, doctors or lawyers or things of that nature.
Right. And the and so her day is spent running errands to for the party, entertaining her old friend Peter, who once courted her and proposed to her in her youth, and her interactions with her daughter Elizabeth and very upper class, well-to-do things. And then there is the character of Septimus Smith, who is a war veteran, clerk, who is suffering from PTSD, or shell shock, as they would have called it in those days. And his wife, who is Italian, attempting to find some treatment for the fact that Septimus is suffering from auditory hallucinations and from suicidal thoughts. The two characters don't ever really meet, but other characters that are associated with one or the other sort of pass each other in the streets.
Right.
And there's moments where, like, the story gets handed off from Clarissa to Peter, to Peter goes to the park and Peter sees Septimus. And so it kind of jumps from person to person. The Septimus and Clarissa never actually interact, but their stories come together at the end of the book. And so there's this external action that is wildly jumping from character to character, and it's being regularly noted by the hours of the clock ringing on Big Ben.
Yeah. The entire book takes place over the course of a single day, starting at, I don't know, perhaps 8 or 9 in the morning and ending probably around the time Clarissa's party is wrapping up, probably fairly late in the evening that night. But yeah, it does take place in a single day. And one of Septimus's doctors ends up attending the party that evening. It's interesting when you were talking about a podcast full of very stuffy upper crust British folks talking about this book. That amused me on its face because this book does not generally have a kind opinion of sort of stuffy upper crust British people in general.
Wolfe said about this book that she wanted this book to encapsulate all of life as she saw it. She wanted to have life and death. She wanted it to be about class, and it very much is about class, because Clarissa Dalloway is an example of the moneyed class whose concerns are not the same as the concerns of the people out on the street, certainly not of Septimus, who as a veteran afflicted with mental illness is very close to losing his job and his position and down on his luck. There are scenes of you know, beggars in the streets. One of the things that's funny about Clarissa Dalloway is she has this wonderful way of making everything about herself.
Yeah.
You know, so everything that happens in this book, Septimus, sadly, after he is told by the specialist he's seen that he's going to be taken away and put into a home for a rest cure. Sophomore Lit listeners who remember the yellow wallpaper know how well rest cures work. He jumps from his window just as his doctor is coming in and kills himself. When the specialist who had planned to have him committed to the asylum, doctor was Sir
Bradshaw,
William
Bradshaw.
Yeah, Sir William Bradshaw. Yeah, comes to the party and starts and discusses. Oh, we're sorry, we're late. There was a very sad incident with one of my patients. Clarissa's first response is, "Oh, why are they bringing up this at my party?"
Yeah. She's extreme. Yes. She's got a few moments like that. There's a moment earlier in the book as well where she's married to a man named Richard Dalloway, who is described as extremely sort of almost boring and conservative in his day-to-day life. He's not like interested in the difference between him and Peter is this sort of emotional romantic who pretends to be very stoic, but is actually very tumultuous in his attitude. Whereas Richard Dalloway is very steadfast and like, you know, very regimented and is like scandalized a little bit by reading Shakespeare's sonnets. This is how like down to earth puritanical in a way, but not exactly judgmental this character is. But he's also portrayed as very good-hearted and intending to actually help people and doing things to the best of his ability to help people in a government capacity. He's going to a meeting to discuss the Armenian genocide at one point, and Clarissa, when trying to recall what Richard is doing, keeps on saying, I can't remember if it's Armenian or Albanian or something. Something's going on. And has no regard whatsoever for this very distant, but very massive foreign political affair.
Clarissa Dalloway is a fascinating character. She's also an infuriating character. Yeah. And I was trying to find the quote, and I couldn't find it, but she had a quote once about saying that critics deem certain books great because they deal with war, and they deem other books as trivial because they have to do with women and their salons. And so this is her book about, in some ways, the life of the domestic life of women, and she's trying to treat it with a certain amount of sensitivity and grace. On the other hand, she really takes Clarissa to task for some of her pettiness and her certainly her complete obliviousness to life outside.
Clarissa is sort of both obsessed by and sickened that she has become this member of this gilded class, I guess you should call it. She's really embraced the role, but at the same time, she frequently has these waves of sort of self-hatred, and she has this responsive hatred towards this woman, Mrs. Kilman, who's also a very mixed character, a character that I feel very... I have very differing feelings about over her portrayal, but she knows that her reaction to this woman is ugly, but she also feels it's somewhat justified, and that's kind of the truth. And her character, her friends, Peter and Sally, who is mostly portrayed in flashbacks, but shows up at the end as well, also much older than... There's a great deal of flashbacks to the three of these characters as young people, maybe in their late teens or early 20s, as very carefree young people and the people they became later in life. They have this kind of mixed response to Clarissa as an adult, somewhere between seeing the person she was and kind of despising the person she is, but still gravitating towards her because they're so entwined with her because of their past.
Clarissa, as a teen, wasn't simply courted by Peter, the ex-boyfriend or ex. I don't know if he ever rose to the level of boyfriend, but he aspired to be her boyfriend, at least. She knew him as a teen, but she also knew this woman's Sally.
Septon, I believe her last name is. I can't remember her married last name offhand. By the end of the book, she's married, and as she often repeats, has five sons.
Right, and this is the other scandal. This book is Clarissa remembers sort of obsessively this kiss that she shared with Sally, and has this strong stirring of passion. Thinking back on Sally, and there's this, people like to point to this book as Wolf's own working out of her bisexuality tendencies. But the funny thing is, you know, she thinks back on Sally as being this daring, fascinating, penniless child. She came from this family that was in ruin, and there was something scandalous about her as a teenager that excited her. And now that she's grown up and gotten married, she's become a kind of a boring housewife, and Clarissa is a bit disappointed with her in that way. But similarly, Peter is very disappointed in Clarissa for not being the exciting, enchanting girl he knew her to be, the girl who was interested in literature and finer things, and now she seems to be completely taken up in this world of being an upper-class housewife. And yet everyone is still drawn to this potential in each other. There's still Clarissa, when Sally shows up, Clarissa still sees the reflection of the girl she fell in love with, and Peter, the book ends with Peter looking up expectantly at Mrs. Dalloway as she enters the room, and it enters what's the last words of, like, there she was.
I think it was "there she was," which is after Clarissa has had this sort of personal revelation spurred on by, even though she was initially despairing that the subject of Septimus's death had interfered in her party, she sort of absconds to her room and has this personal revelation about, like, we could go into this more, but sort of like the purity of yourself or the purity of your soul, and then returns to the party and returns to Sally and Peter, her oldest friends, whom she had neglected for the entire night. And the book ends just before their reunion with the words, "there she was," sort of implying that maybe the Clarissa of old had reemerged at the end, though obviously that's fairly ambiguous.
It's telling that Clarissa is able to take Septimus's tragedy and turn it into something of an object lesson for herself, an object lesson about maintaining the purity of spirit against a world that's going to break you down. She comes up with, in her head, never having met Septimus, never really knowing any of the actual troubles he went through, she's able to turn it into a story in her own mind about how you need to be pure against the world. And she feels that because Septimus has killed himself, she feels better able to continue on with her own life, which is a very odd way of personalizing a tragedy you have nothing to do with. You know, overall, one of the big themes of this book is about the fact that Septimus, in many ways, stands for this young generation of people who went off and broke themselves in World War One. World War One, unlike World War Two, England was able to stay out of they didn't have any fighting on their shores. They sent their young men to fight in France and Belgium, and they died, you know, by the tens of thousands, and the people came back, and it was a war that kind of got swept under the rug. You know, a lot of these people who came back shell-shocked, a lot of people came back horribly disfigured, because it was also a war that had chemical weapons for the first time. It had very deadly mortar attacks. It had,
it was the first instance of machine guns, I think, was in World War One.
So a lot of people who survived came back horribly mutilated.
Yeah, it was essentially an entirely new kind of warfare from any major war that had existed before, where everything else was sort of the very old-fashioned sort of war you think of in the Civil War, or the Revolutionary War, or even earlier. And it was just the first industrial revolution war, I suppose you would say.
So in some way, Septimus represents that forgotten veteran. And I was going to say that, you know, here in the United States, you could compare it to the way that Vietnam vets were treated by a society that was feeling ambivalent about the war and turned, unfortunately, that ambivalence toward the veterans who returned. Sure. You know, the I think the trouble was, you know, there's many things to admire about British stoicism and politeness and tact, but it isn't particularly good at dealing with extreme trauma, and it isn't particularly good at dealing with extreme, you know, these very damaged people who came home, and people didn't really know what to do with that. And also they didn't have a very good understanding of the mechanisms of PTSD or shell shock at that time.
And another similarity perhaps between Vietnam and the First World War is the reasoning for the First World War, much like Vietnam, was extremely nebulous and political and didn't feel very, I don't know. I think people found a difficult time trying to justify it, which is not so true of World War II, obviously.
It's interesting to think about all those things, because at the very beginning of the book, when Clarissa is going out, she's going to go buy flowers for her party, and there's this exuberance she feels as she walks out of her townhouse, and there's a line that says, "For it was the middle of June, the war was over, except for someone like Mrs. Foxcroft at the embassy last night, eating her heart out because that nice boy was killed, and now the old manor house must go to a cousin. Or Lady Boxborough, who opened a bazaar, they said, with a telegram in her hand, 'John, her favorite, killed. But it was over, thank heaven. It was June.' She's just ready to push this whole thing aside, you know. Right now, it's the early 20s. It's a time of opulence. It's also a time of, new liberties. At one point in the book, Peter is fascinated to note that people can, is it Peter or is it her? Someone in the book is fascinated to point out that you can talk about water closets now in public.
I believe it's Peter, because he had been away in India for a number of years prior to the start of this book, and England was quite different when he came back.
So there's a kind of an exuberance to to the wealthy class. It's a time of economic growth. Of course, we all know what's just around the bend at the end of the decade. But right now, you know, people are kind of happy to forget the war if they can. Now, that's not to say that Mrs. Dalloway hasn't been touched by tragedy. She survived the Spanish flu. It's kind of dealt with very tangentially. It's not they talk about the illness she had.
Yeah.
The Spanish flu, I've mentioned before, I think, on this podcast. I have a particular fascination with the Spanish flu because it had a worse body count than World War I.
Yeah.
And yet I didn't ever, as a kid, I was never taught about the Spanish flu.
No, nor was I.
In high school. And it wasn't until I got into college and I was like reading through a book of history and like they started mentioning it. And I was like, why has no one told me about this? This seems like the biggest event that was happening in the early 20th century. And I had no idea about it.
No, it was very glossed over. And actually, this is something that I think is a recurring theme in the book a little bit, because not only did she survive the Spanish flu, something that's very briefly mentioned, that this woman almost died fairly recently, is very briefly mentioned and kind of forgotten, though she does have, I mean, as much as she hates having death interrupt her party, she thinks about death a lot. Like, it's always at the edges of her thoughts. And the other thing that's mentioned extremely briefly, I think Peter mentions it at some point and is discarded, is that at some point, Clarissa witnessed a tree fall on her sister and kill her. And that's mentioned in yes. one passage and never brought up again. And it's things like this that are like, I think there's a lot of denialism in the book. I think the reason she's so unmoored by the death at the end of the book is because it's something that she doesn't want to think about but thinks about constantly, the same way that Peter pretends he is over Clarissa by saying, I am in love with this woman from India. But all he ever talks about is Clarissa, and he very, very sporadically offers a mention of this other woman who I think is named Daisy and is married with two children. And I think that, the fact that Peter pretends in many ways to be like very proud to have bucked the system and not become sort of a company man like Richard Dalloway or this character, Hugh Whitebread, something like that, who is the picture of like English upper crust emptiness, an empty suit, but at the same time laments his status very often as a poor person. Septimus, I think, in many ways is the difference because he has a difficulty expressing why he feels the way he feels, but he very seldom lies to himself.
One thing that keeps coming up again in this book over and over again is Shakespeare as a sort of a model for British identity that people keep talking about. I mean, Shakespeare is quoted constantly. As you mentioned, Clarissa keeps coming up against death. And one of the ways she comes up against death is as she's out looking for flowers, she looks into a bookstore window and reads lines from Shakespeare about death. Later, there's a point where who's quoting Othello? Someone.
I think that's also Clarissa, because she's talking about if she had died when she was young with Peter and Sally, she would have died sort of in the prime of her life, in her happiest days. But instead, like Othello, she lived on to see tragedy or something of that nature.
Right. Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of there's a lot of this discussion of Shakespeare. Now, Septimus before the war was something of a poet and a great lover of Shakespeare. But when he comes back from the war, there's this line he says, "Here he opened Shakespeare once more, that boy's business of the intoxication of language, Anthony and Cleopatra, had shriveled utterly. How Shakespeare loathed humanity, the putting on of clothes, the getting of children, the sordidity of the mouth and the belly." So Septimus comes back from the war, and he's lost his taste. He's lost his taste for Shakespeare, but part of that is he's lost his taste for Shakespeare as the pretense for war. Like they say about him going off to battle with Shakespeare in his back pocket, and you know, this idea that it's the British are going to save the world for culture.
Yeah, I think it's said that there's a character that is mentioned who is perhaps a teacher or a mentor of his named Mrs. Pole, who would like read his writings and read Shakespeare with him or something of that effect. And he went off to war for Shakespeare and Isabella Pole and nothing else. That was all of England to him before the war.
I think, you know, Wolf is making an interesting point here, which is that Shakespeare, at least Septimus, is taking Shakespeare to task for being too unconcerned with the actual business of life. You know, that it's an interesting criticism to make, because Shakespeare, why people always point to Shakespeare as the author who brought about the modern world, is that Shakespeare was the writer who introduced the idea of a character arguing with himself in the form of soliloquy, that we have for the first time these great interior monologues made exterior so that we can see the human heart in a conflict with itself, as Faulkner would say. Well, but Septimus and perhaps Wolfe as well are hold Shakespeare in contempt for his inability to or his distaste with the realities of life. You know, it's like, it's one thing to write about, you know, the intrigues of court and the and Hamlet's concern about what his duty is to his dead father and to his mother or whatever. And it's another thing to actually write a story about the business of life, about eating and sleeping and the getting of children. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be what Wolf wants to be on about in this book.
I think, yeah. And I don't even know if I'd entirely, at least from Septimus's point, call it fully criticism. It's more like he reevaluates the words he already knew and reads into the existing words this sense of distaste for mankind. Like, I don't think he thinks that Shakespeare is ignoring it. I think he now has the sense that these same words that he used to think were just poetry and beautiful and sort of alighted at the beauty of the world are actually saying humanity and human nature is suffocating and disgusting and stupid and silly. And it's, I don't think he's necessarily taking Shakespeare to task for ignoring that. I think he's just reading the same verses or the same soliloquies and finding this new, entirely divergent meaning in them.
Let's return to the theme of time in the book, because sure. It's a very interesting book for time. As we've mentioned, there is this regular, at regular intervals, we're given these announcements of Big Ben chiming. And there's actually points at which we're told that one event is happening simultaneously with this other event across town, which sort of establishes this this authentic time.
Yeah.
It was precisely 12 o'clock. 12 by Big Ben, whose stroke was wafted over the northern part of London, blent with that of other clocks, mixed in a thin, ethereal way with the clouds and wisps of smoke, and died up there among the seagulls. 12 o'clock struck as Clarissa Dalloway laid her green dress on her bed, and the Warren Smiths walked down Harley Street. 12 was the hour of their appointment. Probably, Rizzio thought, that was Sir William Bradshaw's house with the gray motor car in front of it. The leaden circles dissolved in the air.
Although that's a bit undercut by the fact that there is another church, St. Mary's, that that rings a few minutes after Big Ben.
Yeah.
And it's very funny because it kind of undercuts the whole idea of the authority of time. But for each individual character in turn, we are, as we enter into their minds, you know, we typically, you get like a line of dialogue and then you get maybe two or three or four or five paragraphs of interior thought for the character. And that goes both into the past, but often it even goes into the future. There are moments in the book where we're told a character, like this one character who we never see again, who sees Mrs. Dalloway, says she would never forget in 20 years' time seeing this person. Past and present and future in all these characters. So within their minds, time runs freely. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting way of counterpointing the regularity of the clock.
I think there's definitely a connection between the movement of time and the ringing of the clock, which rings, you know, not just on the hour, but on the quarter hour and at the half hour and all of these things. And like the sort of oppression they have felt as they've grown older, or the death of their characters. Obviously, that's very obvious. But the fact, like, there's a moment early in the story where there is a plane that is doing some skywriting, and everybody is fascinated by the potential of this plane spelling out whatever it could be spelling out. And there's pages from multiple characters' perspectives staring at this plane, and almost simultaneously, within a few pages of that, staring at this car that could hold anybody within it. And then eventually it becomes clear that the plane is just an advertisement for toffee, and there's nothing more to it. It's not a message to Septimus. It's not some kind of great word of peace. It's just, as time goes on, revealed to be the thing it is. And I think that there's this sense of paths closing as time goes forward. There's another passage that I wish I had bookmarked, where when they are talking about their flashbacks, there is this great sense that the potentials they could have chosen, that if she had chosen Sally or Peter or somebody else besides Richard, she could have been this other person, and each of those paths in time closed themselves off. And it was the same kind of, I don't know, it rhymes with the oppression of the British society. I guess maybe because Big Ben, in fact, is a symbol of British society that seals their lives in little by little to be the one thing that it is.
Right. I love the skywriting sequence, partly because it's about the way in which we seek meaning. We look at the world and we seek meaning. Everyone is looking at this skywriting plane, which is a very new thing at the time, a very confusing thing at the time, and trying to make out what it could possibly be trying to say. And everyone, wants it to mean something important. It reminds me very much of when I was a very young child. I lived in New York City from the time I was 1 year old to about the time I was, I think, 6 years old or so, five or six. But I think it was in 1972, I was looking out the window of my apartment building there, and I saw a plane writing out "Happy Birthday, John." And I was shocked, and I called my mom and I said, "Why is it saying happy birthday to me? It's not my birthday." I was very upset about this fact, and I didn't understand how this could have even happened. I didn't really understand that there were other people named John in the world. Many years later, I learned that that was a message that Yoko Ono had given to John Lennon. But I seeing it there as a little boy of 4 or 5, I felt like the universe was trying to speak to me, and they were getting it all wrong. So you mentioned the scene in which there's a car that goes by and backfires, and that's another one of these moments that connects various characters, because characters walking by hear the backfire. Septimus hears the backfire, and of course for him it reminds him of a mortar shell. And in this car there's some great personage. People are like, is it royalty? Is it the prime minister? Who is it? And this is another one of those sequences where we have this fanciful evocation of the future, where the narrator says that someday in the far future, when all of Britain has returned to grass, when London has disappeared, and everyone who is alive now, the line is something like, is moldering dust and gold fillings from their teeth. They said, then the name of the personage will be known, which is a wonderful, a wonderfully funny and strange way that the narrative voice suddenly sort of detaches itself from anyone in particular and wanders off on its own into the far future.
Yeah. And there's a couple of times I feel like where there's a lot of grandeur and to do about someone of very great importance showing up, and then they appear and there's nothing. It's at the end at the party, there's several pages of people being surprised. The prime minister is to show up. The prime minister is coming. The prime minister. And when the prime minister shows up, he barely appears at all. I can't even remember the interaction, if there is any, that Clarissa has with him. He's just sort of there and another person who looks like anybody else. And Yeah, there's so much speculation about who's in this car. Is it the Queen? Is it the Prime Minister? Is it some prince? And ultimately, they don't even bother saying it.
My wife and I were discussing time in this book as we were walking this afternoon. And one of the things that she brought up, because she's a philosopher, is the Augustinian conception of time. St. Augustine famously was trying to wrestle with the idea of it seems like the past and the future don't actually exist because they have no real efficacy. They can only exist in the mind. But he also thinks that the now only exists in the mind too, because it's sort of infinitely divisible. And he discusses time in the terms of how we conceive of past and future are, again, the functions of mind. And I feel like this book is a lot about that, about the way in which our narratives ultimately become functions of our own minds. Everyone is obsessed with memory. Everyone is thinking about the future, but everyone's coming up with a different idea of what their own narrative is. You know, when we see there's a sequence where Peter comes in to visit Clarissa for the first time, and if you break it down, there's probably only about a dozen lines of dialogue in the course of, you know, three dozen pages. But what happens is one person will say something, and then we get their interior thoughts. And in a way, it would be hilarious to just take out all that interior thoughts and try to stage just what they say, because it's not very much. But Peter is coming back. He's trying to make a big show about the fact that he's here in London looking for a lawyer to divorce the woman he's fallen in love with in India, to kind of, in a way, to sort of scandalize Clarissa, to say, look at me, I'm a free thinker, I'm still being ruled by passion and love. And all he can think about is, look at you, you've completely lost your life. And all she can think of is, oh, you completely made a mess of things. What are you doing? Why do you keep playing with your penknife?
That sequence is like a good indication of that. These two people who both think this about each other and in their private moments agree with each other about themselves, because Peter definitely feels like he is a bit of a failure, and Miss Dalloway resents her own snobbishness at times. For instance, the Miss Kilman sequence is a point at which we haven't talked about, I think, Elizabeth at all, which is Clarissa's daughter, but she's sort of being... she's being tutored by this woman, Miss Kilman. Is that correct, or is she more of an
yeah, something like that?
Yeah, has a great understanding of history. It's repeated numerous times that this woman is A+, understood, has the great knowledge of history, and she's sort of initially like, I think Clarissa hates her for reasons that I find both contemptible and understanding. Alternatively. Because she kind of hates her because she dislikes that, justifiably, Miss Kilman thinks that Clarissa is pampered because she is attractive and rich and spoiled. And Miss Kilman is none of those things. She grew up poor and average looking. And to some degree, she does resent her for that. But it's based in a very legitimate social, in a like unequal system of upbringing. But at the same time, Miss Kilman is an extremely judgmental religious person who is trying to wrest control over Elizabeth from Clarissa in order to shape her to be somebody a little bit more like herself. And I enjoy the way that most characters in this book, with the exception of one or two, I would say perhaps Dr. William Bradshaw and Dr. Holmes being the major exceptions, genuinely are, in equal turns, sympathetic and kind of contemptible.
When she has that scene with Miss Kilman, there's a very interesting passage right after that where she's very upset, and Clarissa after Elizabeth has gone out, thinks love and religion, thought Clarissa, going back into the drawing room, tingling all over. How detestable they are. The crudest things in the world, she thought, seeing them clumsy, hot, domineering, hypocritical, eavesdropping, jealous, infinitely cruel, and unscrupulous. On the one hand, we find Mrs. Dalloway thinking back to her childhood, thinking about Sally and realizing that that was never really an option given the society that she lives in, thinking about Peter and wondering what her life would have been if she had gone ahead and married for love. But now she's having this violent reaction to love and religion as these forces for that she finds detestable because they rule your she sees them as emotions taking control of your life.
Yeah.
And she wants to be, you know, as doubtful as she is sometimes about where she is and who she is, and as much as she obsesses over death, she really wants to live a very controlled life. She wants to be absolutely in control. And the idea of being ruled by passion, whether that be romantic passion or religious passion, is anathema to her.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, obviously there's that recurring theme of control over your own sense of self. That's something that comes up with Septimus a lot. Septimus, obviously there's a difference there because a great deal of his problem is that he increasingly feels unable to feel anything. But your earlier point about the scene with Peter and Clarissa reuniting for the first time in a long while also applies to this scene, because I'm sure if you mapped out the scene in which Clarissa and Miss Kilman think about how much they despise one another for probably 20 pages, there's probably 6 to 8 lines of pleasantries exchanged between the two of them and nothing else. And almost every interaction in this book follows the same path. Even the scenes where Septimus is trying to explain to Dr. Bradshaw, like, what is wrong with him, he'll like stammer and then be talked over by somebody rather than actually saying what he wants to say about his own condition. Yeah, there's a lot of people having these, or the scene in which Richard, there's a scene in which Richard goes out and does his daily thing. He's a very routine and frequently called conservative man. He goes out, he purchases some flowers for Clarissa. He comes home and he gives them to her and he is literally unable to say, I love you. He struggles with this for some time and eventually says, well, I think she understood.
Yeah, but one of the wonderful things about this book is that sequence would make you think that this book is something of a comedy of manners on the way that, I guess, the British character is unable to express strong, authentic emotion. But you can contrast that against the sequence that Peter remembers when Richard and Clarissa meet for the first time. And Peter has been trying to get Clarissa to agree to marry him. And just immediately between Clarissa and Richard,
sure,
there is this strange commonality. They keep making these jokes about the fact that Clarissa got Richard's name wrong at first, and there's this point where Peter just remembers that was the point that he realized that they would be married. It was before any expression of love, before any obvious presentation to the world as a couple. He realized that there was something sympathetic between the two of them that he didn't have. As suspicious as this book is about romance, that's as romantic as this book gets.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's alternatively fawning and derisive of so many concepts. And actually, A couple of things that I wanted to mention is earlier we talked about the way in which Septimus, when he kills himself, he does it as a way of escaping, being sort of stolen away to this this rest home. Moments after this moment of clarity he shares with his wife, where he sort of returns to him, his old self, while the two of them are making a hat, and he has this very silly conversation with her about how the hat will look very bad on the woman she's making it for, and they both have this very genuine moment of connection, and he feels untethered by, like, Evans, this old war figure, that the specter of a dead commanding officer that haunts him, or these doctors who are trying to cage him into some life he doesn't want. And then gradually, like, inevitably the doctors come back, and in order to sort of preserve that side of himself, he jumps out the window. So when Clarissa interprets it at the party as someone saving their sense of self, she's actually interpreting it in the way Septimus meant it, even though the two of them never meant. It's strange, and obviously a little idealistic view of suicide, especially considering Virginia Woolf herself obviously would later commit suicide. But I also feel that there's I briefly wanted to touch on, in addition to that, the conversation that precedes it about proportion and conversion being twins. But I don't know if you have any thought about the sort of the way that Septimus's suicide is portrayed, positively or negatively.
Well, what I think about with the suicide, there's that very cool and chilling paragraph where he's contemplating the ways that he can kill himself as he hears his doctor, it's Dr. Holmes, coming up the steps at this point. He looks around, he sees a knife, and he thinks, oh, you can't make a mess of things. And he considers, what, like, there's one other thing that he considers, like, the gas or something like that. And then he says,
he said he considers, I think, sucking on a tailpipe, but he doesn't have the strength for it. And Rezia put away the razor blades, I believe.
He says he's going to jump out the window, and he has this momentary regret because he thinks that it is too much of a cliche. And I find that all really chilling and sad, you know, the idea that he's about to take his life, and yet all he can think about is in the sort of the most abstract and intellectualizing ways. And I guess that's part of the problem he's suffering from, is his inability to feel strongly. Obviously he has to be hurting to do this, but yeah, that I do think about that a lot. Now as to your point about proportion, why don't you go ahead and make that, because I do think that's an interesting it's an interesting word that keeps getting used by Sir William.
I think I think probably the closest thing this book has to an out and out antagonist is Sir William Bradshaw, who is the doctor who orders the home rest for Septimus. And though he is actually in some ways better than Dr. Holmes, who sort of says there's nothing wrong with him, he's perfectly fine, this is all nothing and it'll blow over in a week, he also seems sort of less interested in genuinely helping Septimus than just sort of putting away the problem. There's a big note about how Bradshaw has a way of being despised by his patients, but being beloved by their relations. which the wife, Septimus's wife, Rezia, is sort of the exception to, because she also finds him to be a very cold and evil man who just wants to, like, smother whatever her husband was before for the sake of getting him by, but destroying whatever he used to be, sort of. And his prescriptions, his prescriptions to send him away to rest, to do nothing, it's about getting emotionality into proportion. And there's a several pages long segment about how he idolizes in this way this idea of proportionality in all things, and considering everything even with an even keel and with correct proportion, but that sort of the demon sister of this idea of proportion is this idea of conversion. That in order to accept this person's idea of proportion, you have to convert to this sort of religion of proportion and lose the emotionality or the personality or the individual spirit of who you are to become this perfectly proportioned, societally correct person, which of course reflects on the story of Clarissa growing from a sort of brash girl who was in love with Sally and Peter to this woman who's obsessed with throwing these posh parties for the sake of appearances.
You're right that Holmes just refuses to see anything wrong because he cannot find any physical symptoms. And for him, the mind is not even a consideration. Bradshaw at least sees the mind as a force in one's health and identity, but he thinks that it's possible to select what goes on in your mind in a way. That's what proportion would mean, is that you find this, you know, if something is bothering you too much, then just don't let it bother you that much. You know,
it's almost like that Book of Mormon song.
right. It does speak to, I think, where the field of psychology is at this point. You know, this is 1925. Freud does not have a lot of purchase in popular culture. I think that this is kind of the ending of Victorian ideals about all mental illnesses can kind of be chalked up to an overstimulation of the nerves, and that ultimately what has to happen is that people need to be, stimulation needs to be removed, and eventually the systems will right themselves. You know, maybe a little bit better than just putting people into bedlam or whatever they did in the Victorian ages, but not much.
Yeah. And ultimately, the prescription that Bradshaw, who is supposed to be the top of his field and extremely talented, though again, there are those reservations about how he's much more beloved by his patients' relations than the patients themselves. His prescription is indeed, go to a rest home and don't come out until you weigh like 11 stone six.
What ultimately did you think about reading this through this time as compared to reading it in college?
Like you, when I was in college, I attached myself to this book in a big way. I really, really enjoyed it. And reading it now, it did take me about 50 pages before I started remembering why I liked it so much. But once I did, I saw more and more of it as the story went on. I actually think that it holds up quite well. I had forgotten, frankly, that Mrs. Dalloway and Peter and Sally were in their 50s. I thought they were somewhat younger, even in their older versions. But I don't know. This is somewhat of a... I have not aged as dramatically from... The first time I read it, I probably would have been about the age of these characters in their younger flashback days at, I think it's called Bruton is the place. And
that's her father's estate.
And I'm not quite so old as they are in their present day incarnations. But even still, in some regards, it reminded me of, this may sound slightly silly, but I reread it about a year ago for the first time since I was 12 years old, and feeling the difference in how I related to the characters as children and adults and how they feel about the removal of time and maybe how I feel about the passions of youth and how they relate to them. I do think that there is a way in this where this book seems to evolve with age. So I don't think I responded to it exactly the same as I did in college, but I do think I still appreciated it quite a bit.
Well, I think the comparison with It is an interesting one, because I have often thought, and one of these days, if I ever get the chance, I'm going to ask Stephen King himself. I have often thought that Stephen King cribbed a lot of his technique from Faulkner, because there's this thing that King does in a lot of his books, and his early books, his books from the 70s and 80s, where characters thinking, thoughts interject in italics, and you get sort of partial sentences that only reveal themselves fully later on in the book. And that sort of partial memory that's intruding into the present day feels to me very much taken right out of The Sound and the Fury. And so there is, I think, a stream of consciousness connection in King, at least in the works of like The Shining or The Stand, where there's a lot of interior monologue.
I actually feel that some of the points in Regent Park where he would jump from random person to random person's interior monologue reminded me of some of his books like Salem's Lot or It, that have a large cast of characters in a town and very quickly jump from one to the other.
Now, I'm sure that Virginia Woolf would not be particularly pleased by this comparison, but
probably not.
But as it's interesting, you bring up the age of the characters. I am now 51, so I am 1 year younger than Clarissa, and I can attest to the fact that your 50s, you spend a lot of time thinking about your crazy youth and wondering whether or not you made the right decision at one point or another. I hate to break it to you guys, the younger kids out there, but that's what you have to look forward to. But, you know, I also had a little bit of a harder time getting into the world of this book than I did when I was younger. I think when I was younger, I was much more, oh yeah, give it to me. I'll read whatever crazy thing you put in front of me. And I was reading lots of modernist writers at this time, and I was used to very dense puzzle boxes of stories where you had to sort of tease out what the chronology of a story was. I found it a little bit harder to get into this time, but I did find myself liking individual sentences more. Like I would sit there and I would reread a sentence several times. It didn't really even matter what it was about, but I have a lot of admiration for Woolf's sentence by sentence writing this time. But the other thing I would say about this is, when I was younger, I read a lot of stories where people committed suicide. You know, a lot of 19th century novels end with people committing suicide or coming to ignoble deaths. That was a trope in a lot of 19th century, early 20th century writing. As I grew older, I started to dislike that as a trope, because I thought the author is plumbing this for dramatic purposes, but suicide is not something to treat very lightly. And I was a little bit skittish about reading this book again, because I remembered Septimus's End. It is a difficult book, but I will say, she does a marvelous job with Septimus. He is not, his suicide is not really presented as heroic. She doesn't try to make it into any kind of object lesson about, oh, watch out, this will happen to you if you aren't careful or whatever. It's dealt with sensitivity. If you don't like books in which someone committed suicide, don't read this book. But I think that this book does it about as well as anyone can.
Yeah, it's a fair assessment.
So I've done To the Lighthouse. I've done Mrs. Dalloway. I guess next I have to do A Room of One's Own.
Yeah, I guess.
Or Orlando.
Have you done Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf yet?
I have not done Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. That would be a good one to do.
Yeah, that's a that'd be an interesting read.
That's
yeah.
That's not a play that gets taught in high schools, but it is a play that gets taught in every intro to theater class that you take.
If you're familiar with the band The Mountain Goats, even though I've never heard them say it publicly, I am convinced the song No Children is about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Thanks to my co-host, Zach Powers. His podcast is The Revisionists. The reading this time was by Jean McDonald. Thanks to my network, The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Thanks to everyone who took time to write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com or join the discussion on Facebook or the Incomparable membership Slack. And thanks to you, listeners, for sticking with me. I'm sorry to have been so late with this episode. I hope to be out with another episode soon. Next time, we'll continue our stream of consciousness theme when we explore William Faulkner's The Bear. Keep up the reading, everyone, because everything will be on the final.